Good morning. Thank you all for coming to Personal Theology here at the UU Church of Berkeley. We are in our 36th year of providing programs for the mature adult, shall we say. And today we are pleased to present Beverly Allen and Frank Ferrante, and they are going to be talking about transformation. May I be frank, transformation not for the faint of heart. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about our two speakers. Beverly Allen has a PhD and is an internationally acclaimed author, screenwriter, and speaker whose career spans academia, investigative journalism in war-torn Bosnia, and now a deep commitment to rediscovering the spiritual values in ancient texts. Currently teaching at Stanford University and UC Berkeley in the Osher Lifelong Learning Initiative, Professor Allen is writing a book about the sacred feminine principle in epics, fairy tales, and the passionate figure of Mary Magdalene. Frank Ferrante is an author, speaker, and the subject of the award-winning documentary, May I Be Frank. This film chronicles his remarkable recovery from multiple addictions and obesity and his radical transformation from desperation and misery that had him near death. Sometimes described as a cross between Deepak Chopra and Tony Soprano, this Brooklyn-born Italian-American knows how to share from the heart. I also wanted to mention that obviously this is being videoed. You probably figured that out. And that Beverly offers seminars that you can find out about on her personal website, which is Beverly Allen, and that's Allen with two L's, so beverlyallen.net. And her seminars are on the sacred feminine, epics, fairy tales, Mary Magdalene, and Dante today. So please welcome Beverly and Frank.
Hello. Welcome, everyone. Thank you, Anne. It's lovely to be here on this glorious day. Happy Nowruz, happy Easter, happy spring, happy rebirth, happy transformation. You want to add anything?
Happy resurrection.
We wanted to invite you just to turn to someone that you don't know who's sitting near you and introduce yourself. So please do that now. Here's the watch. Wonderful. Welcome, everybody. My son and daughter-in-law just entered. I'm delighted. Yay. Let's take a moment, shall we, to close our eyes and just get present with a calm series of breaths to being here together on this great day of renewal, so that we can all be present to the water that we trust will flow from the two faucets you see sitting, well, you saw before you closed your eyes, sitting up in front of you here. We're the faucets today, not the water. Just for a moment. So this is the day that celebrates rebirth, resurrection, the new, the return of the new. There are so many ways to think about it. And the symbolism of this celebration inspired us to do something that we haven't done before. This is something entirely new for us. For 20 years, Frank and I, who met in a 12-step meeting in Washington, D.C. a long time ago, have been in conversation with each other on a regular basis. And we realize that whatever we're talking about, whatever we think we're talking about, the underlying topic is precisely transformation. So we thought we would try having one of these conversations in public. So pretend we're on the phone with each other, and you, we left the, the speakerphone on. That's what we're aiming for today. So we would like to start by acknowledging each other. I'm the Beverly Allen of the two, and I want to acknowledge what Frank has been to me, one of my best friends, a better friend than I could imagine before I came into my own recovery and learned how to be a better friend myself. Frank is courageous and bold in his seeking, in his spiritual growth. He has done tremendous amount of work. We call it work on himself, not only in 12-step program, but also at Landmark Education, and notably, most notably perhaps, with the Course in Miracles and Marianne Williamson. He is her assistant, has been her assistant in Los Angeles for quite a while now. He gleans a lot from everything he does, and he is so funny. I studied Italian at universities and lived in Italy, and so I learned how to speak Italian. And when we met, we discovered that he learned Sicilian in his neighborhood in New York. So we have that in common, and it's another joy of communication, you know, having this second language, so we can tell secrets most often. Although it can be dangerous because you never know who speaks Italian. So, Frank is a friend I love dearly, and I'm so grateful that you came up from L.A. for this weekend and this event.
Thank you. Is this on? God, it's so odd to hear that, but thank you very much. One of the things, my experience with when I first met Beverly, she had recently published. She had published a book on the atrocities of Bosnia, and she came to Washington D.C. for a number of events dealing with the book. And I was intrigued by her because what she did was an expose, which is talking about courageous. I mean, there's like existential courage, like I'm going to face my demons, and then there's going to a place where they're actually shooting people. It's a whole different level of courage. And so she had just returned from this place, from Bosnia. It was the 90s, obviously, had written about went to the heart of darkness and witnessed things that the images of which probably people wouldn't be able to bear. As a result of that, the government was a little upset with her, and so I met this woman who had bodyguards all the time. So I was intrigued. Who is this woman with she's like this cute blonde with bodyguards. I got to know who this is, man. And one of the things that I learned was the beginning of a long arc of learning is what it means to be next to a woman that is able to stand in her own power. And I began to learn the difference between power and force. And being near a woman that stands in that place somehow brought out something in me that I didn't even know existed. I became more powerful. And ironically, strangely enough, the more powerful I felt, the gentler my spirit became. I didn't have to have a facade. It was being around her made me a better man. and just by virtue of the way she showed up. And I hadn't really been able, either been open or been asleep to it up until my experience with Beverly. And through the years, that was a continuum. She would remind me of who I was when I would start to slip into darkness, and she would help me recalibrate my compass, which is an invaluable thing, because I think most people, when they do slip into their darkness, it's because they forget who they are. And it wasn't like she coddled me or anything, or say, oh, poor guy, it's okay. She would shine a light on that part of me that I needed to get access to. And, you know, there's a lot of other things, you know, but to me, that's the most important thing the most valuable thing in our friendship is that. And that comes rooted in love. It was just the most intelligent and wise experience of love that I ever, you know, that I had. So, thank you.
Anytime. I have to joke because otherwise I'm going to cry. When we talk on the phone, he doesn't say all that.
But that's what I'm feeling. You know, guys don't express feelings, right? Isn't that what they say? Isn't that the thing?
Well, you know, once we gain access to the part of us that really the principle of the sacred feminine describes, because it's always there, we just need to get access to it, then we have open and vastly expanded lives. But you know, Frank mentioned, you mentioned that I had been working in Bosnia. After I came back, I was thinking about how I could stop that stuff. How could I stop the genocide? And, you know, I've learned from many wise people that it's a great thing to take on a project that you can never fulfill. Why? Because it's worth your life. You know, so stopping genocide became my project and became, worth my time, worth my life. And what I realized when I looked at this issue of genocide and mass rape in particular, I had learned from other wise people that when we're looking for a solution to something, it's very helpful to notice what's missing. What's missing? And I saw that what was missing in Bosnia was a respect for the sacred feminine. Not only a respect for women per se, but a respect for the feminine within everyone, and perhaps especially within the perpetrators. Well, at about the same time, the Da Vinci Code was published, and I'm all in favor of popular culture, and there, I loved that book. I maybe not the style, but the plot. And the plot brought me back to a whole new perspective on my upbringing in the Swedish Covenant Church. It gave me an access route to a religion that I had left. And the reason, and the name of that access route is Mary Magdalene. I love to think of myself now as a sort of first century person when there wasn't yet a real difference between Judaism and Christianity. And I know I've shared this a lot with Frank. Should I just go on to the... One of the results then of studying early Christianity more seriously, and some of you know this because I've spoken about Mary Magdalene here before, was that I discovered the Gospels that were excluded from the official Christian Bible. And one of these Gospels is, in fact, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And since it's Easter, I wanted to share with you something that has stunned me in her gospel. The gospel, of course, was written by someone else about her, so it tells the story of Magdalene. It's extremely fragmentary. When you see the photographs of the pages, you think, how could anyone read these little bits and pieces? But it tells a story of her coming back to the disciples after the resurrection event, whatever that was, and they ask her to tell them, since she saw Yeshua, what was that like? And she says, then I said to him, Yeshua, who she is seeing in a vision, keyword, Lord, when someone meets you in a moment of vision, is it through the soul or psyche or psyche that they see, or is it through the spirit, pneuma? I give you the Greek words because those are the ones that appear in the text. The teacher, Yeshua, answered, it is neither through the soul nor the spirit, but the nous between the two, which sees the vision. This is another Greek word, nous, almost impossible to translate. Some translate it as intuition, some as mind. But Jean-Yves Leloup, who has written this commentary on the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, reminds us that in the Gospel of Mary, there's another line that can help us. There where is the nous lies the treasure. There where is the nous lies the treasure. So I have come to think of this as a kind of universal mind or consciousness that we can gain access to through the work of our own transformation. And then we can have the vision of transcendence, of the divine, of ultimate love. Your turn.
See what I mean about stretching, right? We didn't talk about this in Brooklyn. What comes to mind is when I was drinking, people are making these almost obscene gestures about putting the mic.
You pretend you're a pop star.
He must really like me.
Anyway, when I was, people would say, why is he doing, he's drinking, he has a choice, he's making a choice to do that. This is a bone of contention with people, it's a bone of contention with some people. When I was drinking, people would say, why don't you just stop? You have a choice. When I was in that, my consciousness was so restricted that it may well be that I had a choice, but I couldn't see it. And I think that choice comes with an expansion of consciousness. As I woke up, I was able to see that I could live without drinking or without acting in certain ways, then I really had a greater responsibility to, and an opportunity to take that road. I didn't know that was possible. And I'm of the belief that transformation is a continuum. It's not a discrete event. At least I don't look at it that way in my life. If I glance at the timeline of my, the arc of my narrative, it just seems like to me a road of continual awakening. And sometimes when I think back to when I was 20, I'm surprised I got this far without falling under a bus. I mean, it was almost as if I was sleepwalking. And sometimes I wonder, is that true now? I think I'm a little more awake, but at best I have one eye open, one eye halfway open and one eye closed. And I think that the other thing I think about transformation is that, again, rather than a discrete event, it's an aspect of creation, that we are, that everything is an everything. There's no death, and there's no birth. There's just creation, and it's this continuum of something that I get glimpses into that once in a while. And when Beverly was talking about the noose, the middle, the mind, we were talking about that too. That's the Jungian collective unconscious, the collective wisdom that exists, that when we're lucky, we have a moment of access to. I've experienced that at times when I would be talking to somebody that was in crisis, without knowing the answer, had the answer. And I was really clearly aware at that second that that there was something beyond me that was speaking through me. It's not something I have ready access to, but I've experienced it. I've experienced it enough to know that there is something far greater than me out there. But I don't put a face on it, and I don't necessarily put a name on it. There's a term that we have in the 12-step world, a God of our understanding. You know, I think that's a very presumptuous statement, you know, like understand God. You know, I like those people that say, you know, what God wants. I think, well, you know, if I was God, I wouldn't want anything, you know. I would have it all. You know, I may want for you or some, maybe, but not even that. I mean, want is a base human experience. I mean, it's like really wanting is not exactly on the hierarchy of consciousness. And so it's just something I think I just live into rather than delineate.
You know,
over to you.
I was just thinking when you mentioned the collective unconscious, I read the other day that Carl Jung said something like, I'm paraphrasing, when we are our most human, then we have access to the sacred. And a lot of people can think that we are our most human when we are in trouble.
Right.
And when we are suffering. And when we are in our addictions, whatever they are. By the way, Frank's are numerous, and he has gotten recovery not only from the ones you might think about, but also from obesity. He used to weigh 325 pounds. You should see the movie that chronicles this that was filmed by Greg over here. Yeah, May I Be Frank? It's available online, isn't it?
It's available. Just call me.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story. Very inspiring. Very much fun, too. No, so I was thinking about this idea that we are at our most human when we are failing somehow. But, you know, those of us who have experienced recovery from an addiction are grateful for the addiction. Because without it, I mean, I would still be wandering around thinking that it was important to be a professor, maybe, or something else like that. And now my goddaughter has just arrived. I'm so happy. God, yeah. So as you said to me the other day, you know, addiction puts a gun to your head. And then you realize you've got to do something about it, or you'll die, or you'll go insane. I think those are the two alternatives.
Well, actually, when you've lived in that darkness, there are things far worse than dying. And there were definitely nights that I was afraid I was going to live. And so it's I think worse than dying. Dying is a relief at one point in addiction. It's looked upon as a relief. It's not something to fear so much as a relief. And that's, you know, that's when your spirit is really dying, you know. And so I just couldn't bear the thought of continuing that way. And I knew there was another way. And I believe that all addictions are rooted in the same place, and that somewhere, you know, somewhere along the line, my developmental phases of my young life, the cycle of love was fractured, and I developed all these mechanisms to cope and to survive and to get through the day. And the problem is you hold on to those mechanisms well after that situation is gone, and you incorporate them into your life. And so I had a real deep fear of abandonment issue. Everything's an issue now. It's like a whole bunch of magazines, you know. I have an issue. I have a foot issue. My car has issues. Really? Really? People say, my car has brake issues. Really? You have an existential problem with your car. Okay. So,
let me interrupt for a minute, because Frank taught me something the other day. He said dating after 50 is not like dating. It's like going on interviews.
Yeah.
I think that relates. I'm not sure.
It's an organically unfolding conversation.
It's an interview.
Yeah. So I completely lost my train of thought.
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No. Yeah. Issues.
My car has issues.
So as a kid, right, I thought my mother died when I was like 7 years old. She got sick and she went to a convalescent home. For those of you under 90, a convalescent home is where you go to. You know, it's like a rehab now, I guess. Like, you know, it'd be funny if rehabs were called convalescent homes, right? Where are you going? Convalescing. Okay. Yeah, for my heroin. and what are you going to do there? I'm going to take a constitutional. I thought my mother died, and so as a result, I have these terrible abandonment issues, and I carry them into my life and all my relationships, particularly my romantic relationships, because the moment I started to feel love for somebody, right, tagging right along was, oh my God, look at the other side of this. This is going to kill you, right? This is going to, because that's what it feels like when you're a kid. And the thing about letting go of these things, the transformative process, is what I discovered is because you develop these mechanisms and systems as a child, and for a child, survival is life or death. I carried that into my adult life, and when I was on the cusp of transformation or letting go of these things, I felt like I was going to die. The anxiety was completely disproportionate to what I was going to do, right? And so one of the things that also makes it difficult to let go of these mechanisms is because they became a part of my identity. They became a very, very strong part of my identity. I had issues. I had problems with the Catholic Church, big time. I was I had experienced every kind of abuse, but sexual abuse, and probably because I had acne. So I wasn't very cute. But it was very, very violent and very, very cruel and damaging to me. I was from the first grade to seventh grade, just every day, either the violence or the threat of it. So even if you didn't get hit, you were so worried about it that it was as if your psyche was still under bombardment. My dialogue over the years was about how bad the Catholic Church was, and if I was hanging out with you, or we were at a bar having a few drinks, in short order, I would be recruiting you in my crusade against the Catholic Church, and we'd both be sitting there with our vodkas talking about how bad organized religion is. When I finally made peace with the Catholic Church, I we don't have much time, so I want to get into the story, but I was with a Monsignor, and for those of you who are outside that faith, a Monsignor is like middle management. Yeah. And this guy, we through this conversation that we had, I found myself, my heart softening. I went in there to indict this guy. I went in there to really give him hell. And before I took a breath to start talking to this guy and unleash my venom. And before I was able to do that, he said, when was the last time you went to confession? And I thought, this guy's got balls like grapefruits. He's going to ask me my confession. You know, when I come in here to indict him, but when they get you when you're little, they get you. And I started the ritual, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. And I started to tell him things I had remorse about. And in the end of this thing, which was very, very solemn, he said, on behalf of the Catholic Church, he says, I want to apologize for all the wrongs done to you. And then he said, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, I absolve you of all your sins. And now, my son, I leave you to the daunting task of forgiving yourself. And I walked out of that office into this bright Santa Monica sun, and I thought about this U2 lyric that the sun was so bright it left no shadows, only scars. And I thought that a scar is something that's healed. It's just a remnant of something. And I started to feel very empty inside, because all of a sudden this resentment that I had been carrying for so many years in my dialogue, in my heart, and everything I did was gone, and I had to re-identify myself. And that's a transformative process. That's what some people call tomb time You know, the crucifixion would be meaningless without the resurrection. The resurrection would not be necessary without the crucifixion. But it's those 3 days in the tomb that the transformative process happens. That's the chrysalis time. And that's what this country and most, so many people do to avoid with drugs or behaviors or things, or everything that you know that's out there, is to avoid that transformative time where you actually sit with what's going on inside of you, revisit that moment of trauma, and then make peace with it, and then step into the light. And I refused to do that for many, many years because I was afraid of the pain that I was going. I didn't want to revisit that place. But Joseph Campbell, in his beautiful illustrations of the hero's journey, says, "The cave you fear to enter possesses your greatest treasure." And that has continually been my experience. And transformation is like one of those things, like when you, after you go through it, you think, Jesus, why didn't I do that sooner? You know, it's always that way. Like, you know, it's like a bad marriage, right? It's like a bad marriage. It's like, it's over 2 years before you walk out, but you got to squeeze at least 2 years of misery, you know, like from the time until that paper comes in the mail. Because it's like, it's people much rather remain in the familiarity of the misery instead of the uncertainty of what might be ahead. So, over to you.
Well, in my case, you know, we come from different backgrounds. Frank grew up in a neighborhood that made him think that Goodfellas was a documentary. And I grew up in a Swedish immigrant household where feelings were foreign. We didn't do feelings. Some people are nodding here. But we had church, and in church we had heaven and hell. And I spent a lot of my girlhood worrying about hell. It was like an early Bergman film, you know, to grow up like that. And my escape was reading. And I would carry a book with me everywhere. I would read at the dinner table. My parents didn't mind because it meant they didn't have to deal with me. And then when I was 13, I discovered screwdrivers. And then I could drink those and be sociable and still not be feeling the fear of hell or whatever else you want to call it. And so I just want to emphasize an aspect of addiction that often people outside that experience don't realize. It worked. It made me feel good. It became my best friend. I could count on it. That's all I needed. You know, in fact, Anne mentioned that I'm a screenwriter. One of the screenplays I've written is about the first woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was working on this screenplay and taking a graduate course with, you know, brilliant 20-year-olds who could, you know, throw out screenplays on a long night's work, and I was struggling and struggling. And the professor...
Taking amphetamine.
I should. It was too late. I was already in recovery. Oh, maybe they were.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what you mean. Oh, I get it. Okay.
It takes a while.
Yeah. Right. So our professor told me, well, Beverly, you know, this is a worthy project, but there's no antagonist. The protagonist has to have an antagonist. And so I decided I would create a character to represent the disease of alcoholism. And this character actually starts out as a little girl with Marty Mann and is her BFF. This character, this disease, this alcoholism is her best friend. And it works until this best friend abandons her. So that was my experience. It worked, it worked, it worked. It was great until it stopped working. It stopped working, and then I couldn't stop it. So that's what I mean when I say having a gun to your head, you know. Everything was crazy in that moment. And as you say, Frank, you know, it's a terrible fear. How can I live without this? How can I have one day without this? Because I don't know what to use to replace it. There's a hole right here, and I've been filling it with something that has worked, and now I can't, it doesn't work. So then the work begins of learning how to live with a whole different set of steps and engagement with others and service and the spiritual journey. So that's a little bit of my experience with it, but we've written a list here of things. Well, we wrote a list.
Yeah, I just want to say before I forget my, because when I make a mental note, it's like carving it on ice. So I want to just say one of the things that I learned was, you know, I kept hearing this thing about filling the hole, that I have a hole in the soul. And what I found out is there wasn't anything missing. I have no hole. My soul doesn't have a hole. That's the whole point, is that we go back to where we were supposed to, what we had all along. And you use the word restoration, not renovation. Restoration is the in a hero's journey, there's the circle which goes counterclockwise, just makes it all, it's everything's counterintuitive. It's just it's a circling back to where I was in the first place. You know, before the fracture, before the traumas, before all of that, I had everything I needed. But there was always this mad reaching, you know, mad reaching for the girl, the car, the job, the whatever the thing. And you know, if I do this, they'll love me. And it was the whole thing of walking through life feeling like I was inherently unlovable. If you really knew me, you could never love me. And that's where this whole thing about until you love yourself, you can't really experience the full cycle of love. I never really understood. I heard the words and I said it because to sound cool, you know, but I didn't own it. I didn't know what it meant to live that. And it was really kind of difficult to accept the fact that I had everything, but wait a minute, don't I need this? No, I don't.
Well, we were talking on Friday, I think, about these comfort zones that we go to. And then at a certain point, we realize that these are crippling comfort zones. We've got it all wrong. You know, instead of helping us, instead of really assuaging our pain, instead of really giving us comfort, they cripple us. They make us less than we naturally are. You know, we've been talking over the past few days about this transformation issue, and then we got tired of the word, and then we were saying, well, it's resurrection, it's renaissance, it's creation. But what has stood out for me is that transformation is continuous. Birth is a transformation of the little cells, which start as the twinkle in someone's eye, which starts as stardust, which, you know, Einstein shows us that nothing disappears. It just transforms matter to energy to matter to energy to matter to energy. And so what we get to do, in my experience and yours too, I think we agreed, is that when we have kind of what we consider to be a more dramatic transformation, like recovery from addiction, or many other transformations, we think, oh, this is it. This is something unusual. But in fact, it's just a perhaps more dramatic version of what's happening to us all the time. You know, what we get when we follow that path and commit to it is really a restoration of what we came here with, what we came here with. And speaking of what we came here with, it just reminds me of something I learned from a very wise woman many years ago. she found a favorite quote from Émile Zola, the great French 19th century writer. And she had it made into a stamp so she could stamp it in all the books she owned. And this quote reminds me, well, it kind of describes you to me, but it also reminds me of a major aspect of transformation in my experience. And the quote is more or less this. Zola writes, "You ask me what I came to this earth to do, and I will tell you, I came to live out loud." And, you know, everything is created in conversation, and so is our transformation. That's been our experience, certainly mine with you, over the years. We're not always happy when we call each other.
Or when we get off the phone, either.
Oh, yeah.
Frank.
She says that a lot, too.
So, our list reads like this. Transformation is continuous. By the way, of course, that means that death is
exactly.
Also just a part of this continuum. It's just a part of this continuum. And, you know, I fully anticipate that that experience will lead me to another dimension of the nous. You may have other ideas about it. I have a student at Stanford who is researching what do you call that dreaming where you know you're dreaming? Lucid. Yeah, thank you. Lucid dreaming. And one of the concepts that is coming up in research on lucid dreaming now is the idea that our nous goes to whatever place we have created for it to go to during our experience here. So this is a big invitation to mystical practice and spiritual journeying, and also to including the principle of the sacred feminine, the principle that when we have it along with everything else, like the sacred masculine, it'll balance us. It'll give us an integrated personality, and it'll give us a model for being responsible, compassionate, strong, everything I associate with Magdalene and strive for. So, okay, transformation is continuous. It starts before birth and goes beyond death. It's sometimes dramatic, as in, for example, recovery from addiction. It's sometimes euphoric. Frank, that was your word. Why don't you elaborate on that?
There are times when I become aware. I think it takes time to catch up to yourself, right? I really do. I think that in my experience, like, it's taken time to.
It doesn't.
Oh, okay. Well, we want to reach everyone we can. Thank you. The euphoria comes in the recognition of what just happened. You know, I think that. When I realized, you know, I woke up and I realized I didn't need anything. That was a euphoric moment. And I was recently at one of those business gatherings, which I even hate the word networking. You know, I think it only belongs on television sets, you know, networks, that's it. But, like, you know, it sounds like, I don't know, I don't dig it. It feels so calculated. You know, like, when I meet you, I want to meet you. You know, I don't want to meet you for a reason. You know, like, it's just like, hey.
Or know. An interview.
Yeah. Oh, well, that depends on who's talking. Anyway, I was at one of these things, and they were going around, you know, they were saying, okay, well, we have a whole group here. What do you need? it was a spontaneous thing. They called me, and I was talking, and they said, well, you know, you have a book and a movie. Well, what do you need from us? And neither one of those things are really moving well, but that's not the issue. But at that moment when he asked me that, I said, you know what, man, I don't need anything. And I just was so amazed that those words were coming out of my mouth. I didn't need anything. And I rode on that was like the wind at my back. I was really sailing. I just, the whole day I thought, I don't, and it was a very spontaneous thing. It wasn't, and I realized I didn't need anything. I didn't, you know. People think they got to own stuff. I discovered it's not about ownership. It's about access, really. You know, and you really, most of us have access to everything that we need at any given time. But I could not have, there was a time in my life that would have been the very last thing I would have said, that I didn't need anything. So my euphoric experience, just for now, because I didn't know you were going to ask me that, is that is in the recognition, and I look at the arc of the narrative that got me to that place, and I think, wow, whew, man, you know, I'm lucky to be alive. Never mind, you know, healthy and, you know, and having participating in the cycle of love and having people of that I really, really respect and love me back. You know, that's. I would suspect that the Native Americans, when they're out there in Montana or something and watching the sun come up, that they would marvel at that every day because they had the time to do that. You know, and that's the thing. Make time. Anyway, I'm going on a tangent. Go.
Well, that's okay. We're going to draw our conversation to another transformative moment. But... Let me kind of do that by mentioning that we agreed, Frank and I, and I wrote this down. Our experience has taught us that the basic overarching result of all consciously transformative experience is the spiritual awareness of the love that's already always present. So as we let go of so much that we thought was necessary, we are making room for the love that is already there. And when we get this tangibly, it's actually a thrilling experience. In the early 14th century, Dante Alighieri, our favorite author, aside from Frank Ferrante, finished his magnificent, long, three-part poem about the afterlife, the comedy, the Divine Comedy, which includes the Inferno, or Hell, Purgatory, which he essentially invented, and paradise. And he ends the whole thing. He ends paradise by describing his experience of encountering God. And he says, "Now my will and my desire were turned like a wheel in perfect motion by the love that moves the sun and the other stars." That's what we would have written if we had thought about it a little longer. So this would be a good time. We have a few minutes left to open for questions and answers. We're so glad you're all here.
Yeah, and if you have an answer, that's fine, too.
Raise your hand. Raise your hand, and I'll bring a microphone.
Yeah. Hi, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure listening to you guys. Nous?
N-O-U-S, the Greek word, yeah.
Okay, is it also related to the French nous?
Probably not.
Our?
Yeah, probably not etymologically. That would come from nostrum, nostro, and that's a, yeah. Thank you. That's a good question, because one could be confused.
Well, our.
Although it's beautiful. Yeah, poetically beautiful. Yeah.
Okay.
Our, that mind is not my mind, it's our mind. Yeah, lovely. Thank you.
We've got to be careful. This is a smart crowd.
I know. I know. There's one in back. Two in back.
When you spoke about death as transformation, I think you were thinking about the transformation of the person who died. But my experience lately, since my wife died a few months ago, is that it's a transformative experience for the person who survives in a different kind of way.
Absolutely. All those, I mean, I have experienced that myself. Thank you for that.
You too.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss, number one.
Yes, I join
and,
in
and,
that.
And second, he really does like me. And that, you know, at the risk of sounding cliche, you know, we are all connected, right? So how could it not affect you? And in my view, the you know, grief is a very, is part of the poetry of what it means to be human. And the depth of the grief is in my, is also directly proportionate to the depth of love that you had. And it's something that should be honored and held sacred, really. And so, I don't see how one could not affect the other. And so.
Thank you so much for that. Okay, yeah.
This gentleman, okay.
We'll bring the microphone up here after this.
You were mentioning intuition as a mode of knowing, perhaps as opposed to feeling or perhaps opposed to reasoning. And in the 12-step programs, they have a saying that we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. It occurred to me that when you're in the grips of addictions, that mode of knowing is shut down. It's not available to you. It's in within you in potentiality, and that you're recovering it.
Well said. My goodness.
The addiction, another, you can substitute the word addiction for ego. It is the ego in Panavision and Technicolor. And it's also, you know, it's the ultimate state of separateness. Your intuition, you know, the ego doesn't like it when you get close to your heart space because it minimizes its power and its voice. And the closer you get to your heart, you'll notice I've noticed that all of a sudden this voice starts screaming. And the ego always speaks loudest, and it speaks first. God always comes in through the service entrance.
Let me just add that you don't have to be an addict to experience
That's
transformation.
Correct.
Life throws up enough difficulties, even for people who aren't addicted to anything, that living through the difficulties in along a spiritual path will provide that restoration of intuition, even if for a person who's not addicted. It's just that if you do have an addiction, then you're lucky because the gun is to your head and, you know, it's time to do something about it. Yes, we have.
And the other thing is that In my experience, like one of the things I heard early on in my road to awakening was that we shed our addictions in the order in which they'll kill us, and that was my experience. That was the arc of my awakening or recovery or whatever word you'd like to use. But I stopped using lethal drugs, and then I started drinking, and then I stopped drinking, and then I stopped smoking, and then I was like, you know, really out there, like.
people like to call it serial dating. The reality is I was womanizing. And after the womanizing, I discovered all-you-can-eat Indian buffet restaurants and on until I got to the root of the causes and conditions of why I was making these decisions against my best interest that weren't only hurting me, but one of my greatest, you know, the greatest remorse that I have is how it affected other people around me, thinking I was an isolated, solitary person, but I was affecting every single individual that came in contact with me because of the way I was showing up.
I'm a historical novelist, and while I was researching ancient Egypt, I discovered the original form of Easter is the resurrection of Osiris, the god, by his wife Isis. That was celebrated today.
Yes. The sacred feminine comes to the rescue. Absolutely. That's one of the most ancient versions of this springtime celebration. And we see the fecundity of the earth. Oh, isn't it great?
How un-Catholic of you.
Well, I'm sorry we have to stop now. Service begins at everything.
Everything, everything. Thank you so much to all of you for being here. Happy
Easter.
Thank you.